About to Explore. I'm your host, Paul Tordot. This show will feature Dr. Steve Mock with the Denali Rescue Volunteers, the Alex Lowe Foundation, and the Khumbu Climbing Center. Steve discusses becoming a mountaineer, mountain rescue, and explains the history of the organizations and the deep human connection between the two mountain ranges. Steve joined us on Zoom, and we had a few audio issues, so stick with it for a fascinating interview. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Paul. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great. I'm really excited. You have quite the resume, especially as a chemistry professor. So tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into climbing and your connection with Alaska a little bit.
Well, I grew up in Indiana. My wife and I both grew up in Indiana, not exactly a mountain country there, but I enjoyed camping as a kid. And a lot of hiking. I have relatives. I was born in Pennsylvania. I have relatives in Pennsylvania, and we hiked through the hills there when I was a kid. And in high school, my wife and I both belonged to the same church youth group that took canoe trips every year to the Boundary Waters canoe area in Minnesota. And my first wilderness experience was in 1972. I was 16 years old, and we went to the Boundary Waters and spent about 6 days canoeing. I had canoed a little bit before, I had camped a little bit before, but never anything like that, never a wilderness setting like we had. And I absolutely fell in love with the wilderness and did about 6 or 8 more canoe trips over the next few years before we left Indiana. Just before we left Indiana, I spent a week with Will Steger, who is a well-known Antarctic explorer now. This is before he was well-known, but he and another guy named Duncan Storley had a program called Lynx Track that they advertised as a week-long seminar in non-motorized winter travel. So my brother and I, right around New Year's in 1978, went to Minnesota and dog sledded, snowshoed, and cross-country skied for a week in minus 20, minus 30 weather. The entire week, and we had just a fantastic experience, and that was my first introduction to winter camping and winter travel. So the Midwest is what got me to the mountains, sort of. My wife and I decided that we wanted to live in the mountains, and we had a friend who was starting grad school in Montana in 1978, and so we thought Missoula, Montana sounds as good as any place. And we packed up, had a newborn baby, and moved to Missoula. Probably one of the most foolish things I've ever done in my life. Not the recommended way to relocate across the country with a newborn child, but it, based on a few friends that we met there and a small community we got involved with, we managed to make it. I worked as a carpenter, already had an undergraduate degree in biology, worked as a carpenter. Then went back to school to get my teacher certification and taught high school for 5 years. And early in that period of time, my wife and I traveled through the Tetons for the first time. And I absolutely fell in love with the Tetons, with the mountains. They were just so spectacular. And the moment I saw them, I knew I had to climb. And that was my first introduction to climbing, even to the concept of climbing, other than looking at National Geographic as I grew up and saw climbing pictures. And so when I, in the early 80s, I started taking some climbing classes from Exum guides because I didn't know anybody that climbed. And I had kids and wanted to continue to come home. So I took a cautious approach and learned the basics and started climbing at that point. That was kind of my start with climbing.
Steve, what was your what advice would you have? Let's pause there for a minute and talk about beginning a climbing career. And you said you were being super cautious. You had a family to come home to. Was that a route you would describe to people, like how to get into this sport in a relatively safe way? Taking a class or what are some and then I guess what did you do? What's your next progression after that?
Well, I think there's a lot of logic to taking a class. The point of taking a class from an instructor, from a guide, is to learn to climb, learn the basics, learn the safety techniques of climbing. When you go climbing with friends, which is a good way to learn to climb as well. But when you go climbing with friends, your friends tend to be pretty focused on their climbing, and the instruction, the learning process for you seems to be secondary rather than the primary task at hand. And so I think that's taking a class of some sort, working with a guide and instructor is about as efficient as you can be in terms of learning the very basics. And I ended up teaching climbing classes on my campus for about 25 years. And I kind of modeled those classes after what I learned from the Ex-Im guides back in the early 80s. And so that after the one day of, or one basic class, which was several days of instruction, people could go climbing with a friend and not be a hindrance to the climbing. They're not going to lead anything. They're not going to set up anchors. But they've got the basics down, and they can participate in the whole thing and remain pretty safe. So I think it's a good, efficient way of learning to climb. It's a logical, safe way of doing that.
And in that, how important is the rescue components? Like learning, like a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to climb. I'm going to the gym. I'm going to climb. I'm a climber. But talk about the systems part of it.
Most climbers don't know much about rescue systems. Part of it is that it takes away from our time to go climbing, which is primarily why we climb, because we like to go climbing. I think it's some sort of admission, perhaps, that we might screw up at some point. And so we just don't take the time to learn. A lot of professional climbers are not particularly skilled at rescue techniques. We both know Dave Schumann, who's a Rigging for Rescue instructor, and I know most of the dozen or so Rigging for Rescue instructors, and they work with high-end climbers on a regular basis, and they indicate that many, many of them don't know the very fundamentals of rescue techniques, and so that's a whole different field. And I think actually it's useful to have climbed for a few years before you consider really trying to learn a whole lot in terms of rescue techniques, gaining a lot of experience and a lot of kind of intuitive understanding of how these how gravity works and how anchors work and load distribution and direction, and I think all of those things are valuable. But then I think learning that rescue skills can also be highly valuable for your own climbing. I've taken several Rigging for Rescue classes, and I'm impressed with how much I learned after 40 years of climbing. There's still a lot to know.
And talk about the start of that. What are you, when you say you're impressed with what you learned, like name some categories, go through like a little outline of what a rescue class, what people should look for in a rescue class, I guess. If I'm just been climbing, I'm in the gym, I'm starting to go outdoors, and I'm going to take a rescue class. What should they be looking for?
Well, I think there's probably two basic kinds of rescue classes that have different take very different directions. The one I would recommend the most for climbers who are trying to get into or learn a little bit about rescue technique is to take a 1 or 2 day course in companion and self-rescue. So that's you and your team, you and your partner. How do you rescue somebody? You're a leader at the top of a pitch, maybe a multi-pitch route, and you're belaying somebody using a ATC guide or a reverso in the guide mode, and somebody falls, they get injured, and you can't lower them. They're now stuck on the belay. You're stuck with them locked in to the ACT guide, and you've got to figure out what to do now, how to lower them, how to transition, how to escape the belay, how to transition to a rappel, and then get them down to the next anchor, or down to the ground. I think that's a really useful way to start, and it makes the most sense, because that's the person you're most likely to be involved with the rescue is you or your partner. Then there's a small teams or larger group rescue techniques that involve hauling systems, lowering and raising systems, litters. It's much more complicated. And that's usually a longer learning process. Rigging for Rescue teaches those in 5-day courses. But you can get a lot of basic companion and self-rescue in 1 or 2 days of good instruction.
That's great. Yeah, that rescue stuff is, it's a kind of thing we don't think about a lot in any of our outdoor pursuits until maybe it's not too late. Hopefully it's not too late, but until we really need it. I always say an active imagination is a great asset to someone in the outdoors, because if you start to imagine yourself with a partner and having, especially with just two people, you also realize how important that is. Let's get back to your story a little bit. In your climbing history, was there a moment when you went, okay, I need this stuff? Did you have a particularly near miss or incident that triggered that? I need to learn more about this.
Well, in the progression of learning to climb, you realize that there's always so much more to learn, and I don't recall an incident where I really felt like I needed to learn rescue techniques. There wasn't a moment of revelation that occurred, or near disaster that occurred, but when I was living in Bozeman in the late 80s, which is where I was able to get serious about climbing. Prior to that, I lived in rural Montana and had nobody to climb with. And so I was doing very little climbing. I started graduate school in 1985 in Bozeman. And there was a small but very strong climbing community there at the time that I got involved with. I started climbing much, much more. And right around that time, Pat Callis, who's still climbing, he's in his 80s and still climbing, kind of the godfather of Bozeman climbing. He was starting a search and rescue, climbing search and rescue, alpine search and rescue. And I was one of the original members of that team. I'm not sure we knew that much, but we went out and tried some things, and it became pretty evident that to me that I sure didn't know very much about this. I thought I knew something about climbing, but when you start increasing the loads with two people, an attendant and a climber, a patient, it certainly gets much more complicated. You've got to get it right, because you can't just pull up on the rope and correct any problems.
This is Paul Tordot. Listen to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm here with Steve Mock, who's the president of the Denali Rescue Volunteers. He's joined us from Montana. When you talk about, so for the listeners who aren't too familiar with climbing, we're talking physics here. We're talking loads and rescue. So, you know, why don't we try to illustrate that? Talk us through what that all means when you're having an attendant. Who is that? Talk through some of that terminology for us so people understand what that all is about.
Well, it's I'm not the rescue expert. You should be interviewing Schumann to get the real lowdown on it. But if you're climbing with a partner, and you need to rearrange something a little bit, you can usually get them to, even if they're on the rope, they're weighting the rope, you can get them to unweight the rope. So you can make a minor adjustment of some sort. You've got a twist somewhere. You've got things not lined up the way you want them lined up. When you've got a patient, or a patient and an attendant, two people, we're talking 350, 400 pounds of weight, plus perhaps some equipment in addition to that. They can't just unweight the rope, and you have to figure out in advance how to get this set up correctly, how to get the correct direction. Gravity is going to find the direct downward direction. So if your anchor set up not in a line with straight down, it's going to get in a line with straight down once people are weighting that. And you discover that very quickly, and you discover that it's much more complicated to make corrections when you've got a heavy load on the rope. And so that becomes evident pretty quickly. And so being able to learn a system, learn principles, not just memorize a technique and a sequence of events, but learning a particular set of principles. What am I trying to do here? I'm trying to transfer the load from this anchor to that anchor, or from this point to that point. What do I need to do to be able to transfer that load? What do I need to be able to do to release that load? Some sort of releasable system. And I think taking those, and that can be valuable even if you're not in a rescue situation. If you're big wall climbing, you've got you're weighting the rope on a regular basis. You've got a haul bag, and so learning those techniques in a rescue setting can be very valuable just for your own climbing. In recent years, there's been a lot more research done on anchors and anchor systems and force and strength of materials, strength of knots, and it's a lot of times we, as a result of that research, we've learned that we haven't been doing what we think we've been doing. When we equalize anchors, we maybe are not equalizing anchors. Maybe we don't want to equalize anchors. And so I think some of that rescue training can be very insightful just from the standpoint of making your own climbing a lot safer.
Yeah, at APU, we have a climbing class, we call it climbing systems, and Dave McGivern was very influential in bringing in physics into the class. A lot of people are like, oh, I'm going to take a climbing class. I'm like, well, you're taking a climbing class, but you're also taking a physics class also. And that always sort of throws him for a loop, but super interesting. So you're in Montana, climbing in Wyoming and Montana. What was the Alaska connection? Like, what were your next steps in climbing?
During my years in Bozeman, 85 to 89, is when I thought I actually became a climber. I'd taken some classes prior to that, and in 1985, my brother and I climbed the Grand Teton for the first time, and that was a big event for us because we felt like finally we were becoming actual climbers, climbing a real mountain. And then I started grad school in Bozeman, and one of the members of my graduate committee was Pat Callis. He's a chemistry professor, now retired, and he's also a very highly regarded, highly accomplished climber. And so he was a mentor for me, both in terms of chemistry and in terms of climbing. He introduced me to others there who were climbers. And in 85 or 86, I learned to ice climb from Pat. And I tell people learning to ice climb from Pat is like learning to taking lightsaber lessons from Obi-Wan Kenobi. He was one of the original ice climbers and did the first ice routes in Highlight Canyon in 1968 when ice climbing was a brand new activity. And he's still ice climbing in 2022, 40 plus 50 years later. I guess about 60 years later, it's just remarkable. So I was interested in becoming a better climber. And so I took a very systematic approach to things. I kind of looked at where do I want to be in 5 years or 3 years or some period of time down the road. And I knew that one of the things I wanted to do was climb Denali because it's an iconic peak. It's the highest point in North America. It's a big, cold, glaciated peak. And so I thought, to be able to do that, I should probably climb something like Mount Rainier, do a hard route on Mount Rainier. And I thought, well, before that, I probably need to get a little bit of glacier experience closer to home. And so I picked out some peaks that involved some glaciers, in particular in the Tetons, which it turns out don't really count as glaciers. After you go to Rainier, you realize that the frozen ice snow fields in the Tetons aren't really glaciers. They are, but they're nothing compared to Rainier. And on Rainier, they're not really that impressive compared to Denali. So I kind of worked backwards from Denali to where I was, and then started a progression of climbs. And in 88, climbed, did a lot of climbs on the Grand, including in a winter ascent. February ascent of the Grand Teton, which I thought would be good training for Alaska. It turned out it was way warmer than Alaska because we had a high pressure system, and it was 35 degrees above zero on the summit of the Grand at the end of February, which was that was the third time I climbed the Grand, once in July, once in August, and once in February. And that was the warmest I'd been in three climbs. In 89, a friend and I did the Liberty Ridge on Mount Rainier, which I thought was the next big stepping stone towards Denali. We had a semi-epic, underestimated Rainier, maybe overestimated our abilities, managed to survive that without any real scars, a few emotional scars, but no physical scars. And the following year, four of us went to Denali, and we had a good experience. We climbed it pretty quickly. We were young and fit, and could move pretty fast at that point. So that I finally felt like I'd become a climber that I wanted to be at that point.
That's a great progression. And then Denali?
Yeah, we did Denali in 1990. We were, my main partner and I, there were four of us that went, and one partner I'd done a lot of climbing with. We had committed in 1989 to climbing in 1990, and then both admitted about 2 months before we went up to Alaska that had we each known what our financial situations were going to be like, we would never have agreed to it. But we'd already invested a lot of money and made this commitment, so we followed through. And I'm glad we did it. There's never enough money. That's the way we all are. We kind of stretch our means to the very limit. I had discovered earlier that you have to make plans. You can't just wait for a period of time to open up. In the early 80s, my brother and I said every year, if we get some time this summer, we'll go climb the Grand. Well, we never got time because the time filled up with other things. And so in 85, we just decided that we're going to climb it this summer. Here's the dates we're going to go, and we'll just work everything else around that. And that's kind of the approach I've taken since then. You make your plans, and then you figure out how you can work that out. It helps to have a very tolerant and patient spouse.
That's true. That's a really insightful progression, Steve, for people, young people looking at getting even just climbing Denali, starting off in your backyard, and in your case, Montana, and then climbing the Grand, and then Rainier, and then Denali. That's a very similar thing that I've done or did when I was a climber. And I think that's a wonderful story, actually, for people thinking about or having kids thinking about getting into climbing, getting some education, climbing with competent friends or family, and then working your way up to the bigger peaks.
There's a lot of skills on a mountain like Denali or other big peaks. There are a lot of skills that are not necessarily obvious when you're young and not terribly experienced. You look at the difficulty of the climbing on Denali, and on the West Buttress route, it's not that difficult. Well, that's not, the climbing on Denali is not the biggest challenge. Dealing with the cold and the wind, shoveling snow. How do I keep my feet warm? How do I keep my fingers warm under these circumstances? How much do I wear when I'm moving? What's gonna taste good at 14,000 feet or at 17,000 feet? It's those little details that can make or break your trip. If somebody wants to climb Denali, which is a very cold, windy mountain, winter camping, practice just existing in cold weather, whether you're climbing or not. Make certain that each one of your skills surpasses what you need for Denali, because it's going to be this combination of things that you have to put together. You don't want to be pushed to your limit on any particular set of skills that you have.
Yeah, I just tell people, you want to climb Denali, build light a stove and boil water and shovel snow and carry a big pack up a hill.
Yeah. That's it.
And there's a lot more to it than that, obviously, but and the rescue component and the rope systems part. But let's move on to your connection with Alex Loeb before we take a break.
So in the late 80s, when we lived in Bozeman, Alex and Jenny Lowe, his wife, also lived in Bozeman, and it was a small climbing community. So all of us knew everybody else within that climbing community. And Alex was the most prolific climber of the group. He was always looking for partners. So I got to know him, and we spent a lot of time climbing together, some backcountry skiing, trail running, rock climbing, just a whole bunch of stuff. He had many partners at the time, but he and I became pretty good friends and spent a bunch of time together. And he was our local yardstick. He was always better, faster, stronger than pretty much all of us. There were a couple other really good rock climbers there that that were pretty much in his category with rock climbing. But overall, he was just such an exceptional mountaineer, such an exceptional climber. It was during that time period where he was actually discovered on the national and international stage, and we all felt a whole lot better because we knew we couldn't match Alex, and then as it turned out, nobody else could either. So that did, that was a big boost for our young egos at that time. So he and I climbed together in the 80s, and then in 89 I finished my degree and moved on. And about that time, he and Jenny also left Bozeman and took a circuitous route before they eventually ended up back in Bozeman a number of years later. And we stayed in touch, but we didn't climb much together after that. But his death in 99 was a blow to many of us for a variety of reasons. He was just such a tremendous human being that to lose somebody of that caliber, not his his climbing aside, just the caliber of who he was as a person, that was a huge loss. And then the reality that if Superman could die, any of us could die. If he could die in the mountains, then none of us are immune from that death. So it's sort of a real wake up call to just about all of us, what a serious game we were all playing. A number of years later, Jenny and her husband Conrad were in contact with me. I didn't know Conrad till after Alex died. Jenny has some family down here in the Dillon area where I live. And so she spent some time here as a child and young adult, and had I believe a great aunt who left her a cabin on 1 acre, a few miles outside of Dillon. And she wanted to get some work done on that cabin and knew that I did carpentry work and knew that I lived in Dillon. And she asked me for recommendations, for a contractor to do some work on the cabin. And there weren't any contractors available. Everybody was building new homes. You can't make any money on remodeling an old cabin. And so most people want to just stay away from a project like that. So I told her I would help. I would help her work on that, just as a friend, because I used to do carpentry work, built my own house, built some other houses, and I enjoy carpentry. And so I ended up working with Conrad and the three boys, boys that Jenny and Alex had, and that Conrad adopted, kind of got reacquainted and reconnected again with Jenny and Conrad. Through that process, I indicated that I wanted to be involved in the Khumbu Climbing Center. So that resulted in my first trip there in 2008.
This is Paul Twerlock. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking with Steve Mock, who's the director of the Denali Rescue Volunteers. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Steve and talking about the Rescue Volunteers and the Khumbu Climbing Center.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twerlock. We're talking with Steve Mock, who's the
president of the Denali Rescue Volunteers, among a lot of other things. Steve, let's keep going. We left off at the break talking about the Alex Lowe, your connection with him. For the listeners who don't know, Alex Lowe was one of the premier alpinists in the world, really, until his untimely death in the late 90s in the Himalaya in an avalanche. And so you left off for helping his widow and her new partner, Conrad Anker, also one of the, still one of the world's premier alpinists, build a house. And then you got connected with the Khumbu Climbing Center. So let's first talk about the Alex Lowe Charitable Foundation and that connection there and what they do, and then the connection with the Khumbu Climbing Center.
So the Alex Lowe Charitable Foundation was established shortly after Alex died, established by Jenny and Conrad support the Sherpas in Nepal, the Nepalese workers in the mountains there. And part of that program, a big part of that program, is the Khumbu Climbing Center. Big part of the Charitable Foundation is the Khumbu Climbing Center, which is designed to essentially teach Sherpas how to climb Mount Everest, how to do it safely and effectively and more lucratively, the more skill they have. It seems odd to teach Sherpas how to climb Mount Everest because they've been they've been a part of the Everest climbing scene since there was an Everest climbing scene. But they're like anybody else, they're not born with climbing knowledge. They're well adapted, they're strong and they're fit, but they're not born knowing how to tie knots and use harnesses and crampons and ice tools and other things. So the goal is to allow them or to provide a training opportunity for them to do that safely in the mountains. And so that's what the Khumbu Climbing Center does. It was started in about 2003 or four and has been in operation since then. So we're approaching 20 years of operation. So back to my early involvement with that, we weren't actually building the house. We were just remodeling an old, but it was fun to work with Conrad and the boys. And I suggested to Conrad that I wanted to, since I taught climbing classes, I'd love to get involved with KCC. And he said, let's make that happen this year. And that was 2008 that I went. KCC meets every year in January for 2 weeks. And I was able to go even though I had a full-time job because the campus where I taught, I'm retired now, is the only public university in the country to use block scheduling, the Colorado College model of one class at a time. And so each semester consists of four blocks where a student takes one class for 3.5 weeks and a professor teaches one class for 3.5 weeks. And I was able to arrange my schedule so that every January I had a non-teaching block. And so it allowed me the time to go to Nepal and work with the program. My first year there was 2008, 2011, I returned as as one of the co-directors of the program along with Pete Athens, a world-renowned mountain guide and climber. So from 2011 through 2019, Pete and I were the co-directors. And part of that process was to train the local staff to become instructors, and eventually then they have taken over the program starting in 2020. And so there's very little Western involvement at this point, very little Western instructors. It's all taught now by Sherpa instructors, except for the advanced class where we have some Westerners to go over each year. So we've been very happy with that progression as well, they're now responsible for themselves and running their own program.
And how many students are in the program when you're there or when you were there?
There's usually about 70 or 80 students each year. And that's most of them are students in the basic climbing class, which is just climbing 101, starting with assuming they know nothing. They don't know how to put a harness on. They don't know how to put their boots on. They don't know how to put the crampons, or, it's just a very basic, like anybody else. And then there are anywhere from 8 to 18 students in the advanced class, which is essentially a some advanced climbing, but it's a lot of rescue technique as well, small teams rescue technique. And we've had that curriculum was developed by National Park climbing rangers from the U.S. as well as rigging for rescue instructors. And so that's a it's a pretty advanced set of rescue skills that are developed during that advanced class. And we still have we'll have one or two rescue specialists from the United States to go over to teach that class each year. And it's for a couple of reasons. One, it's good to stay current with what's happening in the rescue world. But also, the American instructors provide a little bit of a little extra cachet to the program, and it attracts more of the locals actually, because it's got foreigners there, and so they're assuming they're getting something better than they would otherwise.
We'll have information on the center and the Al Slow Charitable Foundation on the Outdoor Explorer website, and there is a great description. It sounds like they have a new building that was built and opened up. Looks like a great facility.
Yeah. One thing I might add about the numbers of students, you asked about that. We've had close to 1,000 graduates of the program over the last 20 years. And my Sherpa friends tell me that the vast majority of Sherpas working on Everest are graduates of our program. So we've had, I believe, a very significant and positive impact on the expedition world in the Himalayas.
That's really impressive. Let's move on to the connection between that and the Nevada Rescue Volunteers. We'll get to that, but let's talk about you've been all over the place. You're in the Rocky Mountain West, you're in the Himalayas, and you're up in Alaska. And so let's talk about the Denali Rescue Volunteers, what that is. You're the president of it. Tell us about it.
So the climbing season on Denali is essentially May and June. It sometimes starts in late April, kind of ends in early July, but May and June is really the peak season. And there's about 1,000 or so climbers that attempt Denali every year. This year it was about 1,100. The rangers will spend a significant amount of time, the climbing rangers based in Talkeetna, spend a significant amount of time on the mountain. Each of the climbing rangers spends about 4 weeks doing a West Buttress patrol. They call that, where they're essentially climbing the mountain, just like the other climbers, and they're dealing with stewardship issues, trash, poop, doing rescues, whatever's providing information, working on fixed lines, fixed protection along the Audubon, a variety of different things that they do. When they go, it's usually one ranger with three or four volunteers. They don't have enough rangers to staff these four or five person patrols with all professional rangers. And so one ranger will select three or four close friends or close acquaintances that are recommended, who have the skill set and just as important as the skill set, the demeanor, the personality to work on this expedition for a month at a time. And that expedition, unlike the climbing expeditions, does not have the summit as the primary goal. There's a ranger responsibilities are the number one priority. And then hopefully you get a shot at the summit, but you might not get a shot at the summit. The rangers started Denali patrols in the mid 70s. There have been volunteers on virtually every patrol since then. And so these volunteers are really a critical part of the whole ranger mountaineering program on Denali. In 2011, three people founded the nonprofit called Denali Rescue Volunteers that supports the Denali Rescue Volunteers. So there's the volunteers themselves are all Denali Rescue Volunteers, but then there's a nonprofit with the same name that supports that program. And I joined that program in 2018 and joined that nonprofit in 2018. And I've been the director or president of that since then. I got involved with the originally in 2014 with the Ranger patrols, because we had Denali Rangers at Khumbu Climbing Center who are instructors for us. And that was my connection to the initially to the program. And I've just kind of, I've enjoyed my time on Denali and working with the Rangers. I've done West Butcher's patrols in 2014, 16, and 18. I've done three base camp patrols, including earlier this month. Just really enjoy the time I get to interact with the Rangers and the time I get to spend on the mountain with the climbers.
We're recording this in June of 2022, and Steve was just up here for a month. When you're, first of all, with the Denali Rescue Volunteer, the organization you're president of, when you say they support the volunteers, what does that mean?
So we provide two basic forms of support. One is a providing a house accommodations to live in Talkeetna for two or three days prior to a patrol as they're preparing to go on the mountains, some training, packing, organization, food preparation. And then at the end of the trip, when they come back down to Talkeetna, they have a place to stay for two or three days as well. As they clean up the all of the supplies and equipment and do the debriefing before they head back to wherever home is for them. So that's it's a big part of it. We have a house in Talkeetna that we're able to rent from Jamie and David Parkhurst. They call the family bunkhouse. And we're incredibly fortunate to have that place. It's a perfect setup for us. Two blocks from the Ranger Station. It can easily accommodate 4 to 6 people at a time. And so we rent that for about 2 months, the months of May and June into early July. So that's our major expense for us. They give us a pretty good deal on it, but it still costs us some money for that, to rent that facility. And then we provide a bit of a uniform some piece of technical clothing that they can wear that has the DRV logo on it, indicating that they are rescue volunteers and that they're part of the Park Service patrols. So those are our two main expenses. We'd like to increase some of our options. We'd like to be able to support more travel costs. We'd like to be able to support more ongoing training, professional development for the regular volunteers that come back year in and year out. But so far, we've not been able to afford that.
You're 501c3, so you take donations.
That's correct. Absolutely. Yeah.
And we'll have a link to the Denali Rescue Volunteers website on the Outdoor Explorer website, too, if people want to support. Now, let's go back. So there's a connection then, there's a link between all this, you seem to be a big part of between the Alex Lowe Charitable Foundation, the Khumbu Climbing Center, and the Denali Rescue Volunteers. Explain that, how they're all sort of linked and the end result of that.
That's a good question. There's a lot of luck that plays into life, some good luck, some bad luck. I was fortunate to have known Alex and to have become friends with him, and certainly didn't anticipate that more was going to come from that other than the good friendship and the climbing partnership in the past. Following his untimely death, I think that Jenny and Conrad tried to turn that into as much of a positive as they could, which they did with the Charitable Foundation and the Khumbu Climbing Center. And then I admired what they were doing, but assumed I would not be involved with that. And then through this set of circumstances where Jennifer was looking for somebody to help on the cabin, I got reacquainted with Jenny and Conrad and tried to take advantage of that opportunity and said, you know, what I'd really like to do is get over to Nepal with the Khumbu Climbing Center. And that opportunity arose. They provided me that opportunity. And So I took as much advantage of that, not advantage of them, but advantage of the opportunity, and enjoyed that, offered to go in the future. I think they were desperate 1 year for a director. And so that's, if I do that, I've done some administrative work on campus. And as a director of the program there, it's a lot of administrative work. I did some instructional work, but lots of administrative stuff as well, just organizing things. And I love the program. And so I dedicated a lot of time, both while I was in Nepal and back home in preparation each year, lining up instructors, getting donations of equipment, how are we going to transport that equipment, and working with Jenny and Conrad and the rest of the board in that regard. Then with the with getting to know the park rangers, opened up another opportunity, and I pursued that as well. We had 1 year in particular, which was especially challenging. One of the Denali climbing rangers, district ranger, had some travel challenges in Nepal, and I got quite involved with that, and I think he felt somewhat indebted as a result of all of that. And so he got me on a patrol that year, and I continued on patrols after that. So, you know, for me, it was trying to keep my eyes open for opportunities in life, and then when the opportunities arose, is pursuing them with a lot of energy and a lot of effort. So I credit mostly luck and then just tenacity in pursuing stuff.
And then my understanding is that then you were able to bring a student from Khumbu Climbing Center over to Denali to do patrols. And is that sort of the ultimate connection of the end result of your work?
Yeah, that's correct. Although that program had started before my involvement. Okay. I didn't create that, but I have been quite involved with that since my KCC involvement. But we had a couple of instructors who from Nepal, Sherpa instructors, who came over to Denali. But since then, that's expanded to include two other national parks. So when we're able to get one of our young instructors to the United States for the what we call the Sherpa Exchange Program with the Park Service, they will spend a month in Denali doing a ranger patrol, usually the month of June, and then they'll fly to California and spend 2 weeks or so with the climbing rangers in Yosemite, and some of them have been KCC instructors. Some of the Denali Rangers have been KCC instructors. And then after Yosemite, they'll fly to Wyoming and spend 2+ weeks with the Grand Teton National Park Climbing Rangers. And some of them have been KCC instructors as well. And so I've helped facilitate that and make arrangements for that and scheduling for all of that. Our biggest challenge has been that it's increasingly difficult for young Nepalese people to get visas to come to the U.S. because of the possibility of overstaying the visa, and so that's been a challenge for us.
Amazing eye-opening experience for them, though, to be able to come over here and see, you know, what's going on here on Denali, and there's a great training ground for Everest and for the Himalayas.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a combination of the purpose of the program is a combination of the exchange. It's a combination of things. One of the things is a reward for work well done at the Khumbu Climbing Center. But it's also to provide some alternative methods of park management, climbing / park management. And Denali is different from Yosemite and it's different from the Tetons. And so each has their own methods for managing climbers, managing stewardship issues. And we're hoping that this provides some additional insights, some other ideas for the Sherpas who are working on Everest and the other big peaks in Nepal to see what management systems are available. And hopefully they, along with the government in Nepal, can can continue to work towards improving or developing the best, most effective climbing management, park management systems that they can in Nepal.
Yeah. And are there examples, that management thing, we could do a whole show on human waste, but we're talking about rescue primarily. What are some of the things you think that they learn, let's say from Denali versus, let's say, the Tetons? What are some of the differences?
I think the Denali, they learn so much more about waste management. Human waste management, because it's an environment where the human waste doesn't decompose. And so the clean mountain cans that are used to pack out human waste have been absolutely critical in keeping Denali relatively clean. My first trip to Denali was 1990, and I've been on the mountain many times in the last 10 years, and I think the mountain is cleaner now than it was in 1990. I think the policy is to clean mountain cans, the leave no trace, pack it in, pack it out philosophies have been very successful in that. And that's different from the approach that has been taken in Nepal, both perhaps consciously, but also just through the way things have developed. I think those leave no trace principles are not an automatic sort of a position to take. And we've tried to emphasize that at the Kubu Climbing Center, that litter along the trail and litter in camps is not something that the Westerners, the people bringing the money in, like to see. And if they, what we've have found to be effective in trying to instill some of that leave no trace ethic with their students over there is to let them know that when Westerners see cleaner trails and cleaner camps, they tend to be happier clients, and happier clients leave bigger tips. It can be a monetary reward to keep the place a bit cleaner, as well as an ethical reward for keeping it cleaner. So I think looking at management from that standpoint has been very helpful for our visitors, our friends who've come from Nepal.
I'm your host, Paul Twardot. I'm talking to Steve Mock, who's the director of the Denali Rescue Volunteers, among a lot of things. Steve, we're getting ready to wrap up the show here. Talk about a volunteer patrol for those people who aren't familiar with it. Many of us. What's it like? What are some of the if someone wanted to do a patrol, what some of the background they might need to have? Talk about that a little bit.
So patrol is usually 26 or 28 days on the mountain, and then about 2 days prior to that in Talkeetna, and 2 days following that in Talkeetna. So what the volunteers do is accompany the climbing ranger, usually a friend of theirs, usually a close friend or at least an acquaintance. You fly onto the mountain and usually spend a day or two at base camp doing some training, crevasse extrication, rescue training, and then you start climbing up the mountain like other climbers. Unlike other climbers, the ranger is monitoring stewardship issues, making sure caches are buried correctly, checking out the snow bridges, reporting on conditions on a regular basis back to Talkeetna, so that when the rangers are briefing climbers who are ready to come onto the mountain, they have the most recent information on climbing conditions. The rangers take about a week to get from base camp to 14,000 feet, which is what they recommend for other climbers. They'll spend a week at 14,000 feet acclimatizing, dealing with any rescue medical problems that are necessary at that elevation, maintaining the camp, just communicating with the climbers at that point. Ideally, they would then move up to the high camp at 17,000 feet for a week. That's somewhat weather dependent as to whether they get up to the 17th camp or not. And then while they're there, they got a shot at the summit between weather and rescue schedules, they can take a shot at the summit as well. That's not the high priority, but it's certainly something that people like to do when they get the opportunity. On most patrols, people stay relatively busy dealing with rescues in one way or another. It doesn't necessarily mean some dramatic rescue, but it does mean maybe managing a patient at 17,000 feet who has frostbite. And they come down from a summit attempt or a summit day, and they have frostbitten fingers or toes. And the ranger, with the support of the patrol members, will take care of that person until they can probably be flown off by helicopter if the frostbite is bad. And so those can be ongoing. Some of our patrols this year had seemed like one event right after another, and for two or three days at a time. So not much sleep for two or three days as they're managing these rescues. And some are more dramatic than others, often involves the helicopter, which just by itself is more dramatic than just walking somebody down the mountain. So the patrols, I think, are a very fascinating, interesting way of being on the mountain. You're a climber, but you're sort of separate from the climbers in some ways as well, with more Park Service support. Bigger tents at 14,000 feet that were flown in by helicopter. Better food at 14,000 feet that was flown in by helicopter. So in some ways, it's better than being a climber just a regular climber on the mountain, other than you have probably a lower probability of reaching the summit on a ranger patrol than you do as just a private party or a guided party. It's very rewarding. And I've given slideshows about doing ranger patrols. And I talk about one of the benefits is the great food that we have. The Park Service believes that if you're losing weight on the mountain, you're not conducting rescues very effectively. You've got to maintain your strength and your health. And so we eat well at 14,000 feet. And I said, it's really great to be on a patrol. All it takes is 10 or 15 years of your life to become an experienced mountaineer, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of your own equipment, and then volunteer a month of your life, and you get free food. It's really an awesome deal.
That's great. And I think that's a great way to wrap up the show. Steve, thank you very much for your time. This is Paul Torlak with Outdoor Explorer. I've been with Steve Mock, who's joined us from Montana. Steve is the director or the president of the Denali Rescue Volunteer. He's also the past director of the Kumbu Climbing Center, and is on the board of the Alex Lowe Charitable Foundation, and a retired professor of chemistry from University of Montana, Western. And so, Steve, I appreciate your time. And
it's been a pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks to my guest, Steve Mock, with the Denali Rescue Volunteers, and a special thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Torlak, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, stay active, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.